Welcome to Transform Now, the podcast brought to you by robotic process automation pioneer SS&C Blue Prism. Digital transformation has the potential to reshape the way companies service their customers, engage their employees, and manage their operations. Whether you're looking to develop strategies, tactics, or best practices to positively impact the future of work, or you're curious to see how other companies have successfully navigated their digital transformation programs, then this podcast is for you. We're here to help you transform now.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Hairston with SS&C Blue Prism. Welcome to the Transform Now podcast. Today, I'm really excited to have with me a returning guest, Ted Shelton, a partner with Bain & Company. Ted's previous visit on Transform Now was the fourth most popular podcast of 2021. Today, he and I will be discussing his thoughts on the evolving workforce and how company leaders need to change the way they think about and develop human labor. Ted, welcome back. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Thanks, Brad. Well, as you mentioned, I'm the partner in San Francisco that's responsible for business process redesign for Bain and involved heavily in our practice that's focused on delivering the innovations of automation and artificial intelligence to our clients to help them redesign their business processes. And I came to Bain with a strong background in the technology industry. So I'm one of those people that I'm dangerous on the technology topic and I'm dangerous on the business topic. And I try to bring those two things together to help our clients.
It's good to be dangerous in multiple ways, Ted, right?
Yeah, I'm not Tom Cruise by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, it's good to have you back, Ted. And I mentioned your podcast from last year. It was titled The Future of Business, C-Suite Planning for the World of 2030. And it had the fourth highest number of streams of the entire group of podcasts we published last year. So what do you think it was about that podcast that struck a chord with our listeners?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say I'm disappointed that I only made fourth. So hopefully we can correct that this time around and get to number one. Not that I'm competitive, but
right, of course.
But I'll have my mother listen more frequently next time. I think executives and the folks that are trying to drive automation programs at companies recognize that there are some pretty significant cultural barriers to succeeding with these technologies. And you know, that's something we'll actually talk a little bit more about in today's podcast. The technology works. I mean, I'm still amazed when companies come to me and say they want to do a pilot. It's like, kind of don't need to pilot this anymore. We kind of know it works. And really all of the barriers and all the conversations I have with clients are organizational. Mm-hmm. It's people issues.
Yeah.
So I do think that, I mean, the conversation that we had last year and the conversation we'll have again today is a lot about the people and not about the technology.
Right. Right. I agree with that. And just adding my own two cents, I think it was one of the more strategic discussions we had on automation last year. I mean, we're not talking about it as a tool, as a just another technology decision. We're talking about it as a transformational capability that if it's embraced and adopted the right way, and as you said, ingrained in the organization the right way, it can truly change companies from the inside out. And so I think that did really resonate with a lot of people. And I heard a lot of great feedback on it from that perspective. Well, Ted, Bain & Company earlier this year released a really great and very comprehensive white paper called The Working Future, More Human, Not Less. It covered a number of topics related to the nature of work and the workforce itself and how those things are changing. How would you summarize the big takeaways from this paper?
Well, you know, I think there are three. The first is that we have over the last couple of years experienced something that the media has latched onto the labeling of the Great Resignation, talking about how COVID as an event that affected our lives in very meaningful ways mostly for ill, you know, and some people managed to find silver linings, but you know, I think one of the silver linings that people found was a question about their role in the businesses they worked for and whether it was fulfilling. And so a lot of people changed jobs or even left the workforce and decided to pursue other interests. And so it seems like this inflection point where something different is happening and people are thinking differently about work. And I think the first thing that we really highlight in The Working Future is that this is not a sudden event, that this is actually a 150-year long trend in which people are spending less of their waking hours on work. And from generation to generation, we also recognize that the importance that people attribute to work over other activities, whether it's leisure or hobbies or community activities or family activities or friends, that the importance of work has been measurably declining. So if you look at the great generation, work is more important than other activities. If you look at generation Y, it's less important. First generation, for which it is clearly measurably less important. And so what's going on here, and this is sort of the second finding, is that the importance of work is really closely correlated to prosperity in societies. And so we look at countries all over the world and look at what the patterns of work behavior are, and we can see that as each country has continued to become more prosperous, the importance of work to individuals declines. And the explanation for that is that there is a utility value of money that declines once you achieve all of your basic needs. So if I've got shelter and food security and safety, you know, I can have a bigger house, I can have more cars, but actually that doesn't necessarily contribute as much to my happiness as spending more time with friends and family and doing other things that I care about. And so we see the importance of work declining once people reach those basic needs. And that really leads, I think, you know, to this third finding about what employees are going to increasingly want to do. And it's important to recognize that this isn't one sort of uniform population and all having the same reaction, right? There's still people out there that have to flip hamburgers or work at a construction site. So I'm not trying to diminish the fact that we have a very diverse population in even in the Western world, much less the world as a whole, but that there is a general trend line toward people having the ability to make choices about what they spend their time doing. And they're going to increasingly want to spend their time engaged in things at work, which are more intellectually challenging.
You mentioned that this is not a sudden thing. How has the workforce been transforming since before COVID? Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Yeah, I mean, I think the period between the beginning of COVID and now is too short to really describe specific changes. I mean, obviously, a lot of us have been working more from home. Mm-hmm. But, you know, even when I say that, so if you take, well, let's take the U.S. workforce, 50% of the workforce doesn't have the option of working from home. You know, their jobs require that they be at work. They're working at a hospital, they're working in a restaurant, they're working at a construction site, in a warehouse, in a manufacturing facility, you know, public safety, right? So that's 50% of the workforce. And then when we take the other 50% of the workforce, a substantial number require coaching, training, apprenticeship, supervision. They're new to the job, they're inexperienced, whatever it happens to be. And those activities we don't do well through Zoom and Teams and WebEx and these virtual environments. It's much more helpful to be in person. And then that requires then the people that are delivering the apprenticeship or the coaching or the training or the supervision to also be in person, right? Mm-hmm. So it's actually a fairly small, very privileged part of our workforce that can sit there and say, hey, the new normal is I can work from Guatemala. But yeah, good for you. Now let's let the rest of us get back to work. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I don't think drawing a line for like 2020 to 2022 is the right line. I think a good measuring stick is the evolution of the internet. Mm-hmm. So you look at the last 20 years of transformation, the social, the mobile, the cloud technologies that we've all adopted have really fundamentally changed the way we think about work, and in some ways extended the workday into moments of our day, right? Mm-hmm. But in some ways also given us a lot of freedom about when and where we work. And I think that freedom is a leading edge behavior that we're all moving toward as we increasingly have jobs which emphasize our problem-solving skills, our creativity, and our interpersonal connections as the primary value inputs that humans can give into work.
How has the overall employability of the workforce been impacted by technology, in your opinion?
Yeah, thanks for highlighting that, because I think one thing that our employment and unemployment statistics obscure is the number of people who actually have left the workforce. And so I think it is worth people paying attention to a statistic that the Department of Labor does publish called workforce participation. Mm-hmm. And the percentage of people active in the workforce, which is either means employed or actively seeking work, that percentage has declined pretty steadily since the 1970s, right? So this is a 50-year trend and is at one of the lowest points it's been at in our history. And what that suggests to me is that there are many people who are not able, I mean, there's lots of good reasons that people leave the workforce, by the way. Let me not diminish the value that people who choose to care for children or their parents or other people who are ill or have disabilities themselves. There's lots of reasons to not be in the workforce, but the huge percentage of people that are in the workforce or have left the workforce does not mean that they've all gone and done one of those things. A lot of them mm-hmm. are probably leaving the workforce because they can't produce something that the economy values, as they've been forced out of the workforce. And they may be in a shadow economy, maybe dependent upon someone else who is able to work. But I do think that technology is causing that real disruption in our society.
And how would you say that work is also to some degree being humanized through things like intelligent automation and artificial intelligence?
So I think this is actually the really exciting thing for both workers and the enterprise to grapple with. And that is that increasingly, we have the opportunity to redesign work and to look at all the work that we do, whether it's the physical work of manufacturing and warehouses and all and hospitality and all the rest, or it's the digital work of our traditional white collar workforce, that we can look at that work and we can say, which part of this work do we really want people doing? And which work can we actually assign to either physical robotics or digital robotics, and which work can be augmented by machine learning or colloquially artificial intelligence. And as we redesign the way the work is done, we will increasingly focus people. And actually, this is one of the really interesting things, is that the blue collar worker and the white collar worker start looking a lot more similar to each other, because in both cases, the job is evolving to one where they are supervising machines and understanding the data flow that's coming out of the machines in order to make better decisions. And that skill set is going to really radically change the worker. So as we change the work, we're going to change the worker. The worker increasingly then needs to be more analytical, more computer savvy, more technological, and engage in more intellectual activity rather than physical activity. And so we're going to have to educate people differently. We're going to have a continuous training program for our employees as these technologies continue to evolve and the jobs and the work continues to change. We're going to reward them differently. We're going to manage them differently, right? And so all of that means ultimately that we have a huge change in our organizations. And we're going to have a different kind of talent strategy. We're going to have a different kind of management hierarchy. We're going to define the ways in which people work across the organization differently. Right. And so in my view, this is a 10-year wholesale transformation of the way the enterprise functions, something that we really haven't seen for the 100 years of the modern corporation. And I think at the end of that, while it would be very disruptive, at the end of that, we're actually, as people, going to have these fantastic opportunities to be in roles where all the activities we engage in are much more fulfilling, and where they are augmented by machine learning and robotics, so that we can do so much more than we are capable of doing today. We'll have deeper insights. We'll make better decisions. We'll be able to deploy and manage many more resources individually. It is a very exciting place that we'll end up at, given the warning that there's a lot of disruption on that road.
Let's talk about that word augmentation. Do you prefer that word over automation when you talk about kind of the way things are evolving in the workforce?
Yeah, I think augmentation is a much more helpful framing, because we're not eliminating people. Now, if you are a clerk in an accounts payable department, you should expect that there is a structural decline in that occupation, and that, you know, there will be fewer accounts payable clerks, and the job of an accounts payable clerk is going to decline. Because certainly one aspect of augmentation is that there are tasks or activities that people engage in that won't be necessary going forward. That doesn't mean, though, that we don't need accounts payable clerks. What it means is that the job has to change. And so the accounts payable clerk is now going to care more about the exception than about the routine. And is going to use the data that comes out of the routine to inform how the exception is handled. Right. And so the clerk then needs to say, hey, I'm not about moving data from one box to another. I'm about actually making sense of a problem that is occurring, that is an outlier from the normal process, because the normal process is straight through, lights out, no touch. And it's only when there's problem solving to be done that I get involved, right? And so augmentation, though, then describes how the machine provides the information to the individual to handle the exception. And yes, there are tasks that are automated or eliminated, but what we need to do is we need to redefine each of these roles and thinking about, how does a person plus technology do a different job than the person without the technology does?
And how do you think the underlying work is changing? Could you maybe talk about that a little bit further?
Sure. So I think that there's a couple of things that are important to call out. The first that I've already mentioned, which is when we look at work, we have the ability to redesign it, to reimagine it, so that we are choosing to apply people to the places where people will add the most value around the problem solving, the creative and the interpersonal connection parts of that work. Mm-hmm. The implication of that is the work that is rote, repetitive, routine, and also sort of this pattern-based decision-making that machine learning is capable of doing, ends up getting done faster. It gets done with fewer errors. And so there are less exceptions or less problems that are created, but also that there's a data stream about that work that comes out of it that is being captured. And a lot of what we have thought is helpful about an experienced employee was the pattern recognition that they are capable of doing based upon all of the cases or instances of their work that they've seen in the past. The ability for us to instrument the work and instrument the enterprise and extract data about what's happening actually allows people to have that experience without having had the experience, right? And in fact, mm-hmm. have it to a much deeper degree than any one person could ever have. So one accounts payable clerk might see over the course of their work thousands of examples, but a machine will see hundreds of thousands and be able to provide an individual who's in a decision-making role with the insight from 100,000, which a human never would see.
Ted, you mentioned reskilling earlier, and reskilling the labor force gets talked about quite a bit these days. How do you think companies in general are doing that? And are they doing it at scale in the most effective manner?
I think reskilling has a number of challenges associated with it at really every level of the organization. First off, when we ask, well, I'll take citizen developer sort of automation done by employees as an example. If you say to a frontline employee, hey, we want you to automate your work, does the employee say, wait a minute, aren't I just eliminating my job? Is this a dead end for me? Right. Mm-hmm. And so there is an interesting challenge right at the front line of saying, how do I actually motivate my employees to want to have their work be automated? Then if I go to the manager level says, hey, why am I having my employees spend their time doing the automation rather than doing the work? I also have heard in a number of instances, the question being raised, if I upskill my employees, will they quit? Right? They're going to go get a better job somewhere else. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, yeah, I think what needs to happen is you need to give them the better job, right? The reason they're not mm-hmm. going to quit is because you as a company then reward them for having invested in them and having them develop these new skills. And so I think there's a new contract that's needed between employees and their employers for upskilling to work. Even at the most senior levels in organizations, I think there's a question about hey, is this really accretive to our enterprise? If we're going to spend this money on upskilling, there's one answer, which is, well, let's go hire the talent we need instead of taking the talent we have already and trying to upskill them. Now, I think one of the things that senior leadership is realizing today is that we have a talent shortage. It's actually substantially harder to recruit from the outside than to upskill the people that we have. I think the other comment that I got from one of my clients, which I thought was very inspiring to me, was we actually have a moral responsibility to our employees to provide this skills training, to either prepare them for a job in the future working for us or a job in the future working elsewhere. The worst thing we can do is say to our employees, everything's fine, you're fired, right? And never sort of say, hey, the world's changing and you're going to be out of a job, right? Let's actually open up that conversation now and start the process of recognizing that, hey, this job market is going to change. We have a moral obligation to you to help you be prepared for that job market of the future.
I really like thinking of it that way, as a moral obligation on the employer. I think that makes a ton of sense. So Ted, let's look forward a bit and let me ask you, how do you envision the enterprise of the future? What does that look like?
Well, first of all, let me say, I think, you know, I've mentioned a couple of times this word disruption. I think it is, first of all, a very bumpy road to get to that enterprise of the future. And we should return in this conversation to the topic of what are the kind of organizational and very human barriers to getting there. But let me pose as a thought experiment that future state where I have put physical robotics in place to handle the blue collar work. I've put digital automation in place to handle the repetitive information processing work. And so both my blue collar workers and my white collar workers are now in a position where they are actually being informed by information streams and being asked to make decisions. So an analogy to think about is, if we think about the evolution of agriculture, first we stood in the fields and we used the labor of our own muscles to plow the field, to plant the crops, to harvest. And then mechanization began to relieve the physical work. So we went from standing in the field to sitting on a tractor, but we still had to sit on the tractor. There's still a lot of physical work to be done. Now John Deere has an automated self-driving tractor. And so now the farmer, instead of sitting on the tractor, is sitting in the control room and monitoring the tractor. Now, there's still people that are going to need to walk out in the field and fix the tractor when it breaks. But even that is a very intellectual activity on balance, as opposed to the physical activity of moving a bale of hay. So the farmer, just like the office worker, is now sitting at a computer and monitoring data and using increasingly sophisticated machine learning algorithms to analyze that data and make predictions. That tractor is probably going to, based on its movements, it's got a tire that's going flat, or whatever it happens to be, whatever the repair order is that needs to go in. And so that enterprise of the future is one where all of the work activities are fully instrumented and where I am collecting data in real time that is then analyzed and provided to different decision makers at different levels of the organization to be able to make the kinds of decisions they need to make. So the front line is saying, hey, I need to go have that tire repaired. Whereas then an aggregate of information across all the tractors is saying, hey, we need to make a product change because these tires have a tendency to fail in a certain way. And a decision maker at a higher level is saying, hey, these tractors are not getting used as much in this season as they were last season. Is there something going on about our competitive environment that we need to respond to? And so that data decision-making intelligent enterprise will be this very different place for workers at every level.
That's a great way to describe it. I agree with all of that. And what I hear you saying too is that we embrace technology, but at the heart of it, work is still human-centered. Would you agree?
It is human-centered. I think if we get a little philosophical for a moment about machine intelligence, What we don't have today is any visibility into how a machine would have a preference or a desire or an ambition, right? These are things that human beings have.
Right.
And so for the foreseeable future, humans will have to say what's important and what do we focus on and how do we direct these machines? Now, we may direct a machine in a way that the machine has outcomes built into its programming, but we're still going to need to supervise those machines to make sure that we are running our companies in a way that ultimately serves the needs of the people that those companies are designed around. And we can talk about some great sci-fi future where machine intelligence is flying around the universe, making paperclips or whatever it's going to do, you know, to steal from Neil Bostrom, if people know that reference. But I think in our working lives, we should expect that all of these machines, all of the way that we construct the enterprise is at the service of humanity and creating a more prosperous, more abundant, and better world for all of us.
Ted, final question for you. So what is your call to action to company leaders? What should they be doing to prepare for the future of work?
Well, it's here, Brad, that I'd like to return to the point that I made earlier about people and how it's really about the barriers that we have as individuals and as organizations that will prevent us from more rapidly adapting to this changed future that we're describing. So three things to take into account as leaders in the enterprise think about what to do next. I think the first is to recognize that this is not a one-time event. And I like this framing, I'm stealing it wholesale from an analyst who used this before, that digital transformation is not a project. Digital transformation is an operating model. It is a change in the way that you think about how you will operate today and forever going forward. And it means consistently looking at how your organization is structured, how you're properly using the technologies to be able to continuously change your organization and thus engaging in that change. So you're not doing it and done. You're doing it and doing it and doing it. So that's the first point.
Okay.
I think the second point is for people to get on board with these kinds of transformations. Companies need a new contract with their employees. And what I mean by that is the incentive models that we put in place. Today, we put an incentive model in place to say, hey, get this many widgets out the door, process this many invoices. How do we instead incentivize people to say, you are a part of transforming your work and you're going to be rewarded for participating in that transformation? And it's incentives at every level. It's the most senior level in the organizations and the most frontline role as well. Everyone needs that new incentive model, that new contract. And that really brings me to the third and perhaps most important point, which is, given the scale of transformation that needs to occur, organizations need a change capability within the organization. It is a business-led, IT-enabled capability that is continuously looking at the work of the enterprise and understanding how that work is going to be changed by the technical innovation that's happening, and is responsible for organizing how human resources helps manage the change and manage the relationship with employees and those incentive models I talked about, how business actually learns to manage the work differently and organize the work differently, how IT partners to be able to provide these new classes of workers in the environment, and ultimately how that also changes how organizations are making the decisions and thus growing more rapidly, creating more value, operating more quickly, providing better experiences both to employees and customers, right? So that change function, we haven't seen very many companies fully embrace the skill sets that are necessary to put into that capability. But I think that is the most pressing need, because I think companies, whether they like it or not, their talent strategy is going to change. Their organizations are going to change. And it is better to be a proactive agent in managing that change than to let it simply happen to you.
That is excellent advice for company leaders. Thank you for sharing that as we wrap up today. Well, Ted, it's been great having you on the podcast again. I really appreciate you coming back and sharing your thoughts and insights on the radically evolving workforce. And as you said, it's not going to stop changing. it's a fact of life going forward. So company leaders do have their hands full, and I think you've given them some really important things to think about to that end. So thank you for being here and sharing what's on your mind, and I wish you the very best.
My pleasure, Brad. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Transform Now. For more insightful discussions on digital transformation and more, check out our podcast channel where you'll find all of our previous episodes. And to make sure you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast player. And if you like what you've heard, please leave us a review. For more information about digital transformation and the future of work, check out blueprism.com to learn how SS&C Blue Prism's digital workforce is enabling enterprise transformation now.